Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, and thanks for joining us. Well, this week Australia's played host to one of the world's most distinguished biblical scholars and historian of early Christianity, John Dominic Crossan. Best known for his work on the historical Jesus, Crossan was co-chair of the Jesus Seminar, an attempt by a group of distinguished scholars to come to a common view of what Jesus really said. At the invitation of the Common Dreams Progressive Christian Network, John Crossan is in Australia to present a series of lectures on the power of parable. We've recorded that series and we're going to bring it to you as part of our Summer Sunday Nights specials in January. In Sydney on Friday evening at Pitt Street Uniting Church, Professor Crossan turned his attention to the question of violence and Christianity. And tonight, as a special first hour feature, we'll bring you that public lecture. Professor John Dominic Crossan, the man these days most often identified with the search for the historical Jesus, was in town for a lecture series at the invitation of the Common Dreams Network. And tonight, we bring you his public lecture on one of the great challenges to faith, is God violent?
How to read the Christian Bible and still be a Christian. I'm trying to imagine a Christian theology of the Christian Bible. By the Christian Bible, I mean that small library disguised as a book and presented as a story that begins in Genesis and ends with the book of Revelation. And I'm looking at it very much from inside, from a Christian point of view. Let me get rid immediately of one answer that has been roaming around for some time, namely that the God of the Old Testament is a God of violence and punishment. But the God of the New Testament is a God of love and mercy. The only thing wrong with that is that it is not true. And I say that not with any sense of ecumenical courtesy or even post-Holocaust sensitivity. It simply is not true, and you would know that if you have read the Bible. Because you know, of course, that one of the most violent books in the entire Bible, and in fact one of the most violent books in all the canonical literature of the great religions of our world, is the final book of the Christian Bible, the book of Revelation. And I'm very, very much aware of the beauty of that 21st chapter, but unfortunately you have to get there by wading through blood. So my problem is this. Anyone who has gone through the Bible could draw a line down a page and put all sorts of horrible things about a violent God commanding violent things. Not just people doing violent things, but God commanding violent things. And on the other side of the page, you could put a list of God doing magnificent things. So what are we dealing with? We have clearly two visions of God. It's not a monorail, in other words. It's like a bi-rail right through the Bible, through the entire Bible. A violent God, a non-violent God, a violent vision of God, if you will, a non-violent. What do? Do you have to mix some sort of a Christian cocktail of so many parts violence and non-violence depending upon your personal ethical taste or your denominational tradition? What do you do with it? So the first thing I want to do tonight is to take a couple of probes into the Bible, especially at the start and at the beginning, to see this pattern, this duality of God, and then to ask, what do we do with it? It is certainly lacks integrity to pick out all the bad cop God stuff and ignore all the good cop God stuff. But vice versa also. Just an example to get us going. This is Isaiah. It's a famous line you all know well. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And Micah saying exactly the same thing. I think he's been copying. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they make war anymore. The prophet Isaiah, the prophet Micah. But what about the prophet Joel? Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weakling say, I am a warrior. Now they're both there. So what are we going to do with this? Let me begin a first probe at the start of the vision, of how it begins. And then I will go a second probe at the end. But first of all, I want to remind you of something. Those who added up all the time spans and genealogies in the Bible came up with the idea that it looks like creation was about 6,000 years ago. This is Shakespeare in As You Like It. The poor world is almost 6,000 years old. And in 1642, John Lightfoot, Vice Chancellor of England's Cambridge University, figured it out that creation took place on Sunday, September the 12th, 3928 BCE, as we say, at 9 a.m. And across the Irish Sea in 1650, as if theologians hadn't enough problems in the early 17th century, James Usher, the Archbishop of Armagh, Primate of all Ireland, and Chancellor of Dublin's Trinity College, came up with Sunday, October the 23rd, 4004 BCE. Now, it is so easy to mock this. It's so easy to laugh at people talking about early thousands who we know we're talking millions. But once the laughter subsides, we should ask the obvious question. When they're making it up, why did they come up with, let's say, 4000 BCE? You know, if you're doing it, why not make up 10,000, 100,000? At least when the Sumerians imagined they did hundreds of thousands of years. Why so precise? In other words, what happened in Mesopotamia, because the story begins around the Tigris and the Euphrates in a garden, as you well know, around 4000 BCE, as we say it. And as soon as you ask the question correctly, then you know, of course, the answer. It is when the Neolithic Revolution climaxed with what we call the dawn of civilization. The Neolithic Revolution is when the domestication of animals, the domestication of cereals, led to the domestication of people as they settled down in farming communities instead of nomadic life or hunting-gathering bands. They settled down between the Tigris and the Euphrates. And 4000 BCE is about when you could imagine the Sumerian Times reporting in their headline, Neolithic Revolution finished. The dawn of civilization on the Mesopotamian plains, what we now call Iraq. But the dawn of civilization, when the settled communities, farming communities, created civilization. That's what it's used to mean. Which meant, of course, that as the food expanded, population increased and pushed outwards, and around the cradle of the dawn of civilization were two midwives. One is escalatory violence, and the other is imperial outreach. Because those outside wondered, could they not come in and take it? They had to work all year with the dikes and their canals and all this irrigated hard work. But if you hit them around harvest, it was all free. So around the dawn of civilization, you get escalatory violence. And that is what the Bible tells us. I'm now talking literally in chapter 4 of Genesis. Cain, who is the farmer, kills Abel, who is the herder, and builds the first city, says Genesis 4. And that's as good a summary of the Neolithic Revolution as anyone put in a couple of sentences. But this same story, as you go from Cain killing Abel down to Lamech at the end of chapter 4, that's maybe five generations later, says, I have killed somebody for even hitting me. And if anyone were to kill me, my tribe would exact 70 times 7 fold vengeance. So the Bible summarizes what happened at the dawn of civilization. Farmer kills herder, builds city. And of course, in the long haul of history, the city will eventually kill the farmer, but that's another story. Farmer kills herder, builds city, violence escalates. Hold on to that vision throughout the entire discussion. First of all, then, let me look at justice in the Bible, that word justice, and watch how it both applies to a God of non-violent, distributive justice, but also to a God of violent, retributive justice. Distributive justice is about everyone getting a fair share of whatever we're talking about. Retributive justice is about punishments. Let me begin with the opening story in Genesis 1. It is an absolutely, deliberately artificial account. The person who wrote this is from the priestly traditions of Israel, so it will be a he, knew exactly that he did not know what happened, but he was quite certain he knew what it meant. So he tells us how God created the world in a week. In a week. It's not about the 6 days of creation, it's about the 7 days of creation. And how do I know he's making it up? Because I can watch him cheat. He looks around at all the stuff that has to be created, and he keeps saying it with the same phrases. Then God said, let there be, and there was, and God saw it was good, and there was morning and evening. When you're learning Hebrew, this is the dream chapter you start with. You get a couple of phrases down and you're on a roll. And then you get to chapter 2 and the dream is over. Then it's hard work. It's particularly the artificiality. The artificiality that tells me this person knows what he is doing. But as you're reading through it and you're counting out these, and God said, all of a sudden you say, wait a minute, there's 8 of them. We're in trouble here. We're going to end up with a 9-day week. So you can watch this person cheat. That's why I'm talking about artificiality. On day 1, there's one God said. On day 2, there's one God said. On day 3, there's 2 God saids. 2 chunks of creation. Day 4, 1. Day 5, 1. Day 6, 2 more. So this person is going to get all creation squished into 6 days because the crown of creation in this story is not us. We are the work of a late Friday afternoon. Not even God apparently does best work on a late Friday afternoon. The 7th day is the crown of creation. The Sabbath rest is the crown of creation. We think of the Sabbath or Sunday, we've simply changed the day. Minor detail, that's about going to church. So I want to look for a moment at what the Sabbath means in the Bible. Why is the Sabbath rest so important? And what it is, we're going to see, is that God has crowned creation with distributive justice, with everyone. Everyone needs a rest. Now, maybe we take that for granted. We should move on to everyone getting enough food or getting enough medicine or getting enough education. But in the ancient world, the idea that everyone, even the draft animals, have a right to a day off, makes justice and distributive justice and everyone getting a fair share of the earth the very metronome of history. It's not that, okay, you only get about 50 days off. That's not the point. It's built into the rhythm of life. It's built into the metronome, as I said, of time. The Sabbath day, for example. All of this will be from the Torah. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the 7th day you shall rest. Up to that point, we say, oh, yeah, sure, we know all that stuff. So that. Now, when the Bible says so that, you're going to get the reason. So that your ox and your donkey may have relief, and your homeborn slave and the resident alien may be refreshed. It's clearly addressed to the mothers and fathers, the householders of Israel. They're not mentioned. But the ox and the donkey, I didn't know they went to the synagogue, as it were. Clearly, this is not rest for worship, it's rest as worship. God has built rest for everyone into the rhythm of creation. Deuteronomy, 7 days is a Sabbath to the Lord your God, you shall not do any work, just what we expect. You or your son or your daughter or your male or female slave or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock, even the chickens, are the resident alien in your towns. so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you. So the Sabbath day is about putting the right to rest. I mean, if you have a slave in the ancient world, you do have to feed the slave, but you don't have to give the slave rest, ever. Yes, you do, even your draft animals. The Sabbath year. All of these texts I refer to are from the Torah, from the law, the covenantal law of Israel. The Sabbath year is about rest for the land. Now you think, well, that's just good agricultural rhythm to let the land refresh itself. It's just good agricultural practice. But the reason for a year of complete rest for the land, why? Because you and your livestock and the wild animals may have it for food. The wild animals have it for food. There's nothing in here at all about good agricultural practice. Every 7 years, all debts have to be annulled. You have to go back to zero base, as it were. Every 7 years, and God says, I'm watching you. Don't figure out that by the fifth or the sixth years, no loans. The seventh is coming. I too can count, says the Lord, as it were. Slavery. And we're not talking here about the slave economy of the Greco-Roman tradition. We're talking primarily about people who had to be sold into slavery because of debt, possibly sold into slavery to save the family farm. 7 years, maximum. Maximum. After 7 years, slaves must be freed. The Sabbath Jubilee. So we've gone from the Sabbath rest built into creation, Sabbath day, Sabbath year, to the Sabbath Jubilee, which is after every seven cycles of 7 years, the 50th year, all land must go back to its original owner. So if I've managed to get my hands on your land somehow in between, God says the land belongs to me. You're all tenant farmers and resident aliens. So every 50 years, it goes back to its original owners. Now, we scholars rush in at this point because our major job is to put out the fire. And we say things, probably correctly, we're not certain that they really did this every year. Maybe they did it once after the exile, but we're really not sure they did this every year. It's very difficult to see how they could do it. But wait a minute, this is Leviticus. Are we suggesting that maybe we got it all wrong, that the Ten Commandments are actually suggestions? If we can skip the Jubilee, why couldn't we say, well, any six or seven will do? Maybe the Ten Commandments are just suggestions, like, you know, like red lights in Florida, for example. So maybe it is true that they never observed the Jubilee. But that creates a problem. That is a vision of divine justice, of a God who wants God's world distributed fairly, however you figure out how to do it, and says quite clearly that you don't own the land, so you can't buy and sell it. It's mine. You're stewards of another's property. And that vision goes all the way through the Bible, because the Sabbath, of course, goes all the way through the Bible. And it has very little to do to say you need to have Sunday morning off so you can go to church. It really has nothing to do with that. It has to do with the most basic thing, even more basic than, say, education or medicine or even food for them. Rest. Everyone has a right to some rest. Now, maybe we take that all for granted. But in this story, it's built into creation itself. It is the crown of creation. So I'm going to say distributive justice is the crown of creation. That's the first book, Genesis, of the five books of the Torah.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest, Professor John Dominic Crossan, from his public lecture on Is God Violent? We began at the beginning, the book of Genesis. From here, Dominic Crossan continues on to look at God as he's presented in the last book of the Torah, Deuteronomy.
Turn now to divine justice as violent retribution. And by the way, I do notice, I'm not certain in your country here or in New Zealand, but in America we've almost come to use the word justice whenever it appears without any qualification to mean retributive justice. In the Bible, when you find justice mentioned without any qualification, it's distributive justice. I'm looking now from the opening of Genesis 1 to almost the closing of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 28. What you have there is a series of blessings if you obey the Lord your God, and of concomitant curses if you disobey the Lord your God. And these are very, very empirical things. For example, if you will obey the Lord your God, physical, animal, and human fertility, plenty of water and rain, security from your enemies, victory over your enemies, example. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before you. That's pretty clear and pretty empirically verifiable. Curses for disobedience not only negate all of those by reversing them, but add all sorts more of hard things, anything you can think of. Physical, animal, and human infertility, lack of water and rain, physical diseases, insecurity from enemies, defeat by enemies. Example, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out against them one way and run away before them seven ways. Before I go on, let me just pause for a second to ask ourselves a very, very simple question. Is that true? Said by God in the conclusion of the Torah. But is it true? Israel is a tiny piece of real estate which was the hinge between the three known continents of the ancient world, Africa, Europe, and Asia. Anyone who controlled the Mesopotamian plains and wanted to get at Egypt or vice versa was coming right through you. You're living in a very, very dangerous place. And geopolitically, from our point of view, you could say if these people had spent their lives on their knees praying, the only difference is they would have been killed on their knees praying. They are on the high road of empire. You might as well have set up your tent on a major highway and wonder why you keep getting hit by trucks and say that God must be punishing you for it. Within the Old Testament itself, they're already seeing problems with this. They're still saying it. Oh yeah, we're still saying it. You still find people today after a disaster saying, what did I do to deserve that? First example, if God always punishes bad and rewards good, what happens when a very, very good king dies young? Or a very, very bad king lives long? For example, good King Josiah is killed. How are you going to explain that theologically? Your history and your theology are on a collision course. What about Manasseh, who's as bad a king as they have in their whole history? Now, this is a time when life expectancy is about 29 to 30. Manasseh reigned, 55 years. Now, I'm not mocking this, I really amn't. What I'm doing is, if you have a theory that everything bad is a punishment from God and everything good is a reward from God, and you live long enough, you're going to see problems with it. But above all else, the place where the Old Testament itself shakes its head and says, this doesn't really work, is the magnificent story of Job. And you know the story. Job is the holiest and richest man on earth, as God bears witness, and the Satan, and again, don't think of the Satan as our devil. Satan is sort of God's inspector general. The inspector general, reporting back to heaven, says, Job is just in it for the goodies. Of course he's holy. Look at all you gave him. And God says, no, Job is holy and good. If we take everything away from him, he still will be holy and good. So they wager, as it were. Poor Job is just the guinea pig in the transcendental experiment. So Job is there. He's lost everything, his health and his wealth. And his friends come to comfort him. His friends are what I would describe as fundamentalist Deuteronomists. They're absolutely sincere. They're trying to help him. From their theology, Job is suffering intolerable. Therefore, he's been punished by God. Therefore, he must have done something pretty awful. So Job, they tell him, chapter after chapter after chapter, just confess what you have done and God will forgive you and we're all happy. Just do it, Job. Repent. Ask for forgiveness. And poor old Job keeps saying, I don't know what I did. I mean, he doesn't insist he's perfect. None of that stuff. He says, how can I confess and ask for forgiveness when I don't know what I did so big as to bring this on me? It can't be something minor I forgot about. So they go round and round and round and round and round. And of course, as we're reading all of this, we know it's all wrong. For 30 chapters or so, we know what they're telling Job is wrong, because we've been let in on the story from the beginning. And at the end, of course, what we've always known, God says, you have not spoken right, as has my servant Job. Of course. God has negated Deuteronomy. Now you could say, but it's only one example. Yeah, but there was nothing in the book of Deuteronomy about special exceptions. A sweeping generality, a law, doesn't allow of an exception. Or else the law has to be changed. So my point is that even in the Old Testament itself, before we even get out of it, there is serious doubt cast upon this idea that God is a God of punitive, retributive justice, and that you can correlate it backwards and forwards. If you have sinned, you will be punished. If somehow you're suffering, you are being punished, and vice versa. God is a God of distributive justice. God is a God of retributive justice. They're both there. And I've taken them because they're big enough to go right through the entire Bible. When the disciples ask Jesus, who has sinned, this man or his parents, that he be born blind? At least they kind of figured he could hardly be born blind because he had sinned. So maybe his parents did it. They're thinking good old Deuteronomy. It's still there. There's something about it that seems to be congenial to our psyche. Let me turn to a second theme, looking now more towards the end, towards what's called the eschaton. If that's a word you all know, then you probably know we scholars have made it almost incomprehensible. We have worked very, very diligently so no normal human being can understand it, including, of course, ourselves. And therefore, it has become a marvelous thing to argue about, since everyone may mean something different with it. For Israel, their faith was that God was in control of the universe and that God was just, a God of distributive justice. Their experience, of course, as we just glimpsed, living in that piece of land that could not be other, that the world was clearly unjust and that they seemed to be getting far more than their fair share of its injustice. The long, dreary list for them of the Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians and the Macedonian Greeks of Alexander and now the Romans. And the empires are not getting weaker, they're getting stronger. So if God is a God of justice and God is in control of the world, when is God going to clean up the mess of God's world? That is simply what eschatology means. It's an ordinary Greek word that means the end. It's like enough of it. When, God, are you going to clean up your world? It is not, let me repeat, let me pound on it, it is not about the end of the world. If you find any authors saying that eschatology is about the end of the world, they are wrong. And the reason they are wrong is this. We humans living in the 21st century, can easily imagine the end of the world. We know how to do it atomically, biologically, chemically, demographically, ecologically, and that's only up to E in the alphabet. We've barely got going. So we know how to do it, and so we can imagine it. And we project this back onto people in the first century, Jews, who could not imagine the end of the world because how acutely embarrassing for God. Really not how awful for us, but that means that God made a mistake in creation. So to try and imagine the end of the world as we think of it, I'm going to say, is just not conceivable in that situation. Yeah, it's true there was that flood thing, but once God got that out of the divine system, God said, never again. Never again. So this word eschaton, which means the end, is the end of evil and the end of injustice and violence and war and oppression here below upon a transformed earth. That's their dream. Maybe you can laugh at it and say it's just utopian, but that's what they're talking about. Not the destruction of the world, but the transformation of the world. Then comes this question. And here's again, we're going to get the two sides. Granted that God is going to clean up the mess of the world, what I've called extreme makeover cosmic vision, what's God going to do about the Gentiles? And when the Bible talks about the Gentiles, they really aren't worried about the Irish. No. The Gentiles they know come at them in empire. The Gentiles they're worried about are that list I just mentioned, the Syrians, Babylonians, and the Romans in the first century. The Gentiles come with them as empire, and mostly an imperial boot is on their neck. So what's God going to do about the Gentiles? How is God going to clean up the mess of the world when there's a lot of specific people they had in mind messing it? And especially if you come to the first century, when it's the Romans who are in charge, and in the book of Daniel chapter 7, they thought the Macedonian phalanxes of Alexander were the greatest war machine they could even imagine. Then they got the Romans. Empires were getting stronger, and therefore the urgency of trying to imagine how is God going to clean up the mess got bigger. When they described what this world would look like when it was transformed, they looked at the physical world. They looked at the animal world, and they looked at the social world. The all-bearing earth will give the most excellent unlimited fruit to mortals, grain, wine, and oil, sweet honey from heaven, trees, fruit of the top branches, rich flocks, herds, lambs, sheep, goats. It's like you won't really have vines anymore. You'll just go out there and you'll pull a Shiraz or something, or a Sauvignon Blanc or something right off the vine, bottled already for you. Now, it's easy enough to laugh at that and say, oh, come on. But it is the dream of an earth of plenty. So we're talking about down here. We're not describing heaven. We're talking about a perfect earth. And the animal world, all the animals will be vegetarians, if not vegans. It goes back to that first vision in Genesis chapter 1, where, if you remember, that everyone was supposed to be actually vegan. No blood would ever be shed upon the earth. And again, you could say, oh, come on, how utopian. Wolves and lambs will eat grass together in the mountains. Leopards will feed together with kids, sheep. Roving bears will spend the night with calves. You recall Isaiah, the wolf shall live with the lamb, the leopard lie down with the kid. The physical world will be unbelievably perfect. So will the animal world. But then when they get down to the social world, it seems to be much more possible, shall we say? There will be no sword on earth or din of battle, and the earth will no longer be shaken, groaning deeply. There will no longer be war or drought on earth or famine or hail damaging the fruits. A great peace throughout the whole earth. King will be friend to king in the end of the age. And then indeed he will raise up a kingdom for all ages among us. And it goes on. But back to my question. What is God going to do about Romans, for example? Two different visions, just as you would expect. One of a violent consummation, the other of a non-violent consummation. The great final feast, or the great final battle. Mount Zion, or Mount Megiddo. You're imagining Jerusalem. People will stream to it. Many nations shall come. Let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that we may walk in his paths. He shall judge between many nations and shall arbitrate between strong nations far away. And the line, they shall beat their swords into plowshares. They will all sit under their own vines, not under somebody else's they've stolen, and under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. A great final banquet for all the nations of the world on Mount Zion. That's one vision. And of course, you can say it's utopian, it's unreal, it's impractical, all of that stuff. But there is another possibility. If there is a Mount Zion with a feast, there is a Mount Megiddo. We call it Armageddon, as you know. There is a Mount Megiddo where the great final battle will take place, where God will slaughter those who are evil. Instead of a great final conversion, as it were, at a feast, there will be a great final slaughter at a battle. In anger and wrath, I will execute vengeance on the nations that did not obey. That's Micah. And also, of course, exactly the same image in the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse, that ends the story. The winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for a distance of 200 miles. And then the angel announces there's going to be a great feast, but instead of the great feast that's known from the book of Isaiah, this is a great feast for the vultures of the air. He called to the vultures that fly in mid-heaven, come gather for the great supper of God, to eat the flesh of kings, the flesh of captains, the flesh of the mighty, the flesh of horses and their riders. So they're both there. At the beginning, distributive justice, retributive justice. Though, as I said, it's not quite even there, because the retributive justice is at least discussed, and it's problematic. At the end, again, the same dualism. Will the final consummation be a great battle, a great final battle between good and evil, with God on the side of good, presumably, slaughtering evil people? Or will it be a great final feast? And they're both there.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio across Australia. John Cleary with you. We're listening to visiting Bible scholar John Dominic Crossan. His question, is God violent? After reviewing the canon of Scripture, John Crossan turns to analysis and resolution.
So, starting at the beginning and the end and not going through the whole thing, those are the two visions. Any honest appraisal of our Bible must say they're both there. They run right through. So what is the solution? What is the answer? Is it just as fair to go in there and pick the slaughter violent God and say, well, that's kind of my program. I'd like to get with that, please. Or is it fair to ignore that and talk only about the non-violent God? Or how do you reconcile them? My answer, I think, is stunningly simple. We as Christians have always maintained that in Jesus we see the revelation, the image of God. That in Jesus we see what God looks like if God walked around in sandals. Now, which God do you find revealed in Jesus? A Christian theology of the Christian Bible means we are Christians. We are not called Bible-ians. So the question comes down, is Jesus, the historical Jesus who walked in Galilee at a certain time and who is, for us Christians, the revelation of God, the image of God, our best vision of what God is like, where we see the character of God, is this Jesus violent or not violent? More than anything else, more even, to be honest with you, than anything Jesus says, though of course we have that as well, I'm looking at the clearest evidence in the entire New Testament that Jesus is nonviolent, and that is Pontius Pilate. I'm watching what Pilate judged of Jesus. He crucified Jesus. That tells me a huge amount. And I'm saying that, by the way, as an historical judgment. I think that is as accurate as anything historical from the past can ever be. Pilate crucified Jesus. Now that tells me immediately that in Pilate's judgment, Jesus was a revolutionary, not just a kind of a nuisance. Otherwise, you would probably have garroted him in the barracks and tossed him over the wall. You don't waste a squad of soldiers who have to stay there until this person is securely dead, and iron nails and all sorts of other things, unless you want to make a public statement. Don't do what this person did, or you will die like this person has. That's what crucifixion was about. So from Pilate's point of view, Jesus is a revolutionary who against Roman law and order, who requires a public exemplary execution. But Pilate never rounded up Jesus' followers, made no attempt to do it. That tells me as clearly as I can that in Pilate's judgment, this revolutionary is nonviolent. If he was violent, he'd have tried at least to grab them all, and there'd be at least 12 crucifixions. Pilate got it right. That's what the Romans did, and Romanizers like Antipas, when they were confronted with nonviolent revolutionaries. You execute the leader publicly, and if they're still at it, the next leader, and the next leader, until they get it. That's the way the Romans did it. Let me conclude, before I open for questions, with two parables from the Gospel, one from Mark, one from John. And I don't think these are historical events. That's why I'm calling them parables. Mark asks us to imagine two indicted criminals, as it were, on either side of Pilate. One is Barabbas, who is a violent revolutionary who is in jail along with his followers. And on the other side is, the giveaway is the name, is the true Barabbas, the true son of the Father, who is a non-violent revolutionary. So Mark has asked us to look at two options and ask, as it were, which side are you on? The second parable is the parable in John. That's that scene where Jesus is speaking to Pilate. What Jesus says to Pilate is, John's Gospel, "My kingdom," that is God's kingdom, "my kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, my guys would be in here fighting to get me out. My companions, my disciples, would be in here fighting to free me." I cannot imagine a better summary of the difference between Pilate, whose kingdom of Rome is based, after all, on force. The kingdom of God is a kingdom based on nonviolence, based on the peace that comes after justice. Jesus was a non-violent revolutionary. And thank you, Pilate, for getting at least that part correct.
John Dominic Crossan at Pitt Street Uniting Church, and he then went on to take questions.
This question of Jesus' attitude to non-violence. It seems to me that in the early stages, when he started his mission, that he may have been, in one case, sent disciples out and said, don't take anything with you, just take sandals and stuff. Mm-hmm. He then says, this time, take a sword.
No, I think the transition is that if you go chronologically from Mark through Matthew, Luke to John, the language of Jesus is getting steadily more violent. I don't think Jesus is progressing. I think the accounts of Jesus as you go from, say, 70 to 95 is getting steadily nastier because they're experiencing more serious opposition, discrimination, maybe even persecution. Jesus gets nasty when Jesus's people are persecuted. If you look at Jesus in chapter 5 of Matthew saying, don't call people names, and by chapter 23 of Matthew, he's really doing quite a job of it himself. A snake, brood of vipers, and all of that. Now, we have to decide, do we think Jesus is changing? Or Matthew is changing Jesus? When I look at Mark and then how Matthew reads Mark, I see that Matthew is changing Mark and that Jesus is getting more rhetorically, not physically, violent.
reflecting on what you said about the Christian Bible, you're expressing it as two contradictory themes.
Yep.
How do you see the program of Christians when they have a book built into lectionaries? They have a tradition where both sides were given equal status. How do you see that task of discernment actually rolling out?
I wouldn't even call it discernment. I think we have a very clear answer. We are not the people of the book. We are the people of the person. We are called Christians. We do not say God so loved the world that he sent us a book. The Bible is very, very precious, and it's very, very honest in showing us that tension. The norm of the Bible is a human person who reveals God for us Christians. That's Jesus. Jesus is the norm of the Bible for me. So if I want to know, is God violent or not violent or some mixture, I simply look at Jesus and say, is Jesus violent? And I don't see it. So if I am a Christian, as distinct from what I call a Biblian, when evangelicals say, for example, what would Jesus do? They're quite right. Jesus is the norm for us Christians.
We have Jesus as the image of God, a non-violent sort of image. How do you reconcile that with the other image of the whole of creation and the violence that's in even the formation of the earth? And the fact that instinctually the lion would eat the lamb if they were lying down together.
I define violence as done by a will, by a human will. I don't use the term violence for what a Serengeti lion does to a gazelle. I don't quite know how, even though in Genesis 1, God seems to imagine a perfect world where no blood will ever be shed on it. That's not what I'm talking about, violence. Violence for me is what the human will is, or if you're imagining a divine will, that would be violence for me. I do not think the hurricane is violent. The hurricane is just being a hurricane. We have the intelligence to do something about it if we want to spend our money on hurricane prevention rather than carrier battle groups. That's up to us. But I will not blame the hurricane. But will violence, we are the most dangerous species on earth. That's really not true. We are the only species on earth that could destroy the earth. Because we don't have an inbuilt instinct that tells us not to do it. We only have conscience. We came out of the garden, and the only thing we had going for us was the knowledge of good and evil.
I just wondered what you'd say about, say, the event where Jesus takes a whip and, you know, drives people out of the temple, and also other times when he looks around angrily at people, and this aspect of Jesus that you'd like to hear. And you might say, oh, it's part of the church or it's the community.
No.
But it doesn't portray the actual person of Jesus.
No. Let me focus very much on the incident in the temple. The technical term for that is a demonstration. Actually, riding into Jerusalem on a donkey is also a demonstration, but that doesn't usually raise any issues. It's fascinating that the only one of the four accounts of that demonstration that mentions animals is John, and the only one who mentions a whip of cords is John. That's for the animals. When people say he uses whips on people, it's actually not true. It's just a misreading. What Jesus is doing in this demonstration is, he's closing down the temple because it is no longer the house of God, but the seat of collusion with Rome. And there is a lot of other opposition to the temple for just that reason. It's nothing against sacrifice, nothing against the temple as such. It's the temple, like the people down at Qumran believed, has become corrupt. What he is doing is, by overturning the tables of the money changers, these are the people who are the temple bank, you could call it, the people who come there to make donations, they have to put it into some currency, they're changing. So if you overturn the fiscal basis of the temple and drive the animals out of it, then you've closed down the temple, symbolically. Like going, if you're against the Vietnam War, going into a draft office and pouring, say, pig's blood all over the draft cards. Does it stop the war? No. Does it close down the Pentagon? No. It is a demonstration, and then you stand there to be imprisoned. Please be careful. The whip is only where the animals are. And it's not a whip. It's a thing of cords to shoot the animals out. It's about the only time that most people can even imagine Jesus really doing something. I'm not saying Jesus never got angry. If he didn't, he should have. There's a lot of stuff we should be angry about. It's what we do with the anger that counts.
John Dominic Crossan, biblical scholar, Jesus Seminar member, and here in Australia to present a series of lectures on the power of parables. And over January, in this coming summer series on Sunday nights, we'll present that series of lectures from John Dominic Crossan, presented this week in Sydney at Pitt Street Uniting Church by Common Dreams. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.